ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, presents.
Steven Goldstein worked for the National Science Foundation until 2003. He joined NSF in 1989 as a program director in the Computer and Information Science and Engineering, CISE. Before NSF, he was an MITRE corporation contractor to NASA, helping to establish the NASA Science Network, NASA's entry into TCP/IP research networking. Steve was selected by the 2006 nominating committee to serve as a board member. His current term will run from the end of the 2006 annual meeting through the conclusion of the 2009 annual meeting.
Well, I looked around and I found that there were a couple of international things that nobody was paying attention to. And in particular, two things. We had a cooperative deal with the Nordic countries, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Iceland, Finland, for a network connection of 64 kilobits, which in those days was big. And we had an experimental link that we were awarding to a guy named Larry Landweber, who was a leader in a lot of network development. This was a link that went to France, and what they were doing was setting up a TCP kind of gateway to the protocols that Europe was working on then, the OSI protocols. So it was TCP to TP4 to see if they could make that gateway work. Well, that project was over, and so the link was going to go down. But a lot of people began to rely on that link because there were scientists in the United States that wanted to collaborate with scientists in France, and then other European countries connected to France. So they said, don't let that link go down. Okay, so I could see, gee, I had to make sure that the Nordic link stayed up, that the French link stayed up, and each of these things was a separate kind of contract inside. And if you know bureaucracy, you know that renewing these things can drive you crazy. So I said, oh my gosh, it looks like I could spend a career here going crazy renewing individual contracts. And so one of the things that I did that I'll try and show you in some of the slides was to try and find somebody who we could award a big contract to, if you will, and they would take care of it. We would just say, well, implement a link here, implement a link there. And eventually I succeeded in doing this, and this was called the International Connections Manager. So I guess what I'm saying is I didn't ride in there as a knight on a white horse in shining armor and say, I'm going to do the international. I kind of fell into it because it was open and nobody else wanted to talk to me. And then the funny thing is, after I started all this stuff, they said, oh my God, you're running away with the show. You know, you're competing with us. We should be doing it. Come on, guys, either or. So anyway, that's a little bit of the background. And this was a presentation that I was invited to give at Dartmouth College up in New Hampshire just about a month ago. And just a few minutes ago, before I came up here, I transferred it to the canonical ICANN presentation format. So I hope all the slides will look right. If they don't, I'll go back to the original. So let's give it a try. This is basically what I'm going to talk about here. Some of the early days when we're talking about 64 kilobit links, and then the so-called high-performance links, which were 45 megabits per second, which, you know, was just huge in the middle 90s. This ICM project, International Connections Manager, that I told you about. I'll show you an example of the different ways we used to download files as time progressed. Yeah, I hope you'll get a kick out of it, because now you just see something in a browser and you just click on it and the file comes down. But that's not the way it was. Okay. A little bit about how we then brought even some of these high-performance links in from different countries to connect to each other so that we try to get countries all over the world to be able to talk to each other. And these were the empowered, the rich countries that could afford these links. Also, when Steve Huter just walked in, have you all met Steve? Steve now represents the Network Startup Resource Center, which was one of our other projects that we funded. And this was to help startup networks at the grassroots level. So now we're talking about, you know, the less networked or less developed countries who wanted to get started on things, to provide assistance in terms of a little bit of equipment, books, tutorials, and experts that could be sent over to help at the grassroots level, at the demand level, not at the government level. Because what we found out was that if we went government to government, the government in some of your countries would then choose, they would anoint somebody, and they would choose somebody to run things, not the kind of people that you wanted or needed to run things. So Steve's project, Network Startup Resource Center, always was helping at the grassroots level where people were saying, I want to get something started, and I need some help. And the kind of help that they needed, I mean, the money was always important. We didn't really have much money to provide, but we could provide expertise. Steve would find all kinds of used equipment that, you know, as for example, I had a what was once the most powerful modem around, a 19.6 or 19.2 kilobit per second telebit modem. Trailblazer modem, which, you know, was about this big, with a power supply about this big. And I didn't need it anymore because, boy, we were at 56 kilobits then. So I sent it to Steve, and Steve shipped it off to some country, I don't know where this thing was just gold. So when I say used equipment, it's used as in a very relative sense. Somebody had used it before, but it was very appropriate for some of the countries where he sent it. So that was another one of our projects. And then the thing that I want to conclude with is just to give you some idea of how commercial networking sort of took over, and leave you with the thought, sometimes a depressing thought, that when there's real money on the table, all the rules change. Okay? So a little bit of practical stuff. And I do want to stress that these are my very personal opinions. There's nothing official about them. They certainly don't represent the opinions of my former employer. Okay, so in the very early phases, there were few international links. As I said, we had, from the United States, we had a link to the UK, I think one to Norway. They were mainly used by the military. We had this link to France. We had a link to the Nordic countries. And I think the Department of Energy may have had a link to Germany. I'm not sure if that was in yet. I mentioned how we got through the International Connections Manager and the Network Startup Resource Center. This is yet another overview, I'm sorry. So we're going to talk about the 45 megabit links, how we then transferred, or how we then transitioned into light waves and dedicated light paths, which we call lambdas. And love-ins was just another phrase, you know, lights, lambdas, and love-ins, but how everybody was happy on the net. And sprinkled with a few anecdotal remarks, you already heard a few of these, things that if I was still working for somebody, I wouldn't be able to say, but I'm not working for anybody anymore, so hopefully I can entertain you a little bit with what I regard to be some insights. Okay, so I guess first I wanted to show you how we used to download stuff. And what I'm going to talk about here, and something happened to my hip, so I've got a good pointer, is how we downloaded RFC 1591. Let me see, where is that here? Right over here. RFC 1591 was an early request for comments that dealt with how you would delegate the management of country code top-level domains. Okay? So, in a command line, and this was actually from my screen back at NSF, and the name of the machine there was Note 1, actually. And so I would log on, I would say FTP to UU.net, which was one of the repositories then. And so you get all this gorp come back on you on the screen, and then I'd say, okay, I know where the files are kept. I had to change directory to the internet, to the RFC tables. So then all this was manual input. And then I'd have to tell it to get this file, which was a text file. And I don't know why it said no such file or directory. Oh, I know, it was compressed. I had to ask for the compressed version. And so then it transferred it to me, and then I said quit and goodbye and so forth. So that, remember, now all you do is you just find a page and it's there, and you click on it and it comes down. But that isn't the way things work. Okay, so then the next thing was somebody developed a frontline application called Fetch. And this was for Macintosh, as there were similar things, I guess, in the MS-DOS world. So you could say, okay, just go to this host, log in as anonymous. Your password was actually your email address. Go to this directory, you just type those things in, and then you say fetch. And let's see, I think there's another slide here. So fetch would, little dog would be on the screen, the dog would run, the file would download, or you'd find this file, and you'd download, and eventually the thing would come down. So that was a big improvement on the command line. And then there was another thing called Gopher, you know, go for this, go for that. So it was called Gopher. And a similar kind of thing on Gopher, you'd go, each screen you would go to would then give you, bring you further down in the directory on the system you were looking at, and then essentially you'd click on a file and get it. And then in 1993, there was developed a thing called Mosaic. And Mosaic was the non-commercial thing that eventually became Netscape. And then a whole new era opened up. So that was the first time we could say, you know, go to this site over here, and everything was listed. And obviously, 1591 was somewhere there. You just click on it, and it would come down. So that was sort of bringing us into the modern age. That was 1993. Okay. So initially, we had a T1 NSFNet, which was, at that point, I've got to stress, at that point, this network, which was made up of T1 links, that's 1.55 million bits per second, was the biggest, baddest network in the whole world. And everybody in the world wanted to connect to the NSFNet because it connected to all the universities in the States. And as a matter of fact, when Tunisia connected to us, and I sent Tunisia's network administrator named Monder Makhni, I said, hey, welcome, congratulations, Monder. And his answer was, okay, now how do I get to the Library of Congress? Because that was also connected. So we were, at that point, the center of the network universe, if you will. And that's by far no longer the case. The United States now, I understand our ranking is maybe 13th in the world in terms of network capability. So we've lost it. But at any rate, this was the T1 network that everybody wanted to connect to. And it was really made up of, of regional networks, and these were the names of the regional networks that were connected together. So the regional networks connected to the universities, and then the regional networks were brought together by the NSFNet, which was only 1.5 megabits per second. Okay, and to my house now, I get 5 megabits per second from my cable company. But the whole country there was this. And at about that same time frame, by the way, in 93 or so, I visited Poland. And Poland was connected, the whole country was connected to the internet at 9.6 kilobits per second. And I remember stupidly trying to download my mail from NSF in the command, you know, I was using a thing called MHmail, and basically I gave the command to download my mail, and I probably had like 200 messages queued up because I hadn't read email. And then as soon as I gave that command, I said, oh my God, no, 9.6 kilobits, the whole country's on 9.6 kilobits. It's going to take forever. And I couldn't stop the command because it would probably take another 5 minutes before my next command would, you know, get recognized in the queue. So, I mean, that's sort of how things were in those days. So, at some point we said, well, we need a faster network of 45 megabits per second because we're already overloaded at T1. And we didn't have the budget to afford it in those days. So they created a company which could then sell some of its bandwidth to commercial users, and that company was called ANS, Advanced Network Systems, and it was actually founded by, the president was a former vice president of IBM, and it took me a couple years before I could write to my colleagues and say, ANS, am I the last one to realize that ANS was SNA spelled backwards? Systems Network Architecture of IBM. But anyway, so we found this sort of virtual network connecting our regional networks at 45 million bits per second. And that was, again, the sort of the next generation NSFNet that people still wanted to connect to. And I mentioned to you that in the ICM program that there were a growing number of international networks that wanted to connect to us. In order to expedite things, we made an award to Sprint. In general, we try to work cooperatively with other countries by paying for the U.S. half circuit. And even that wasn't totally fair because of competition. Every international circuit, I think still to this day, is basically based on a notion of two half circuits, one going this way and the other one going this way. And each one is sort of owned by the telecommunications company in the country where it starts. So the U.S. half circuit, because of competition, was always much, much less expensive than the half circuit from the other country, where there was usually a monopoly telephone company, that was probably run by the dictator's cousin and was a cash cow for the country, so that there were no breaks there. But the best we could afford to do was pay for the U.S. half circuit. And in some cases, we couldn't even do that because I had a very limited budget. So what we did was we paid basically with Sprint what we call the port management fee, which at least covered some of the cost, but certainly not enough. Well, we began to upgrade our circuits, and instead of just 64 kilobits, we started getting some T1s in, and then they reached full capacity. And in 1995, we put in a T3 circuit that sort of stopped in London and then went on to Stockholm just in time for the IETF conference, the Internet Engineering Task Force conference, which was being held in Stockholm. Now, just to give you an idea again how things were, this went across the Atlantic at 45 megabits per second, but then had to be converted to European standards, and so went at E3, which, what was that, 34 megabits per second up to Stockholm? That was the first international private line of that capacity that was ever leased. And in order to get it, the vice president or the president of Sprint International had to assert to the part of his company that provided the links that this would be up for 15 years. And there was no way the government could guarantee 15 years, and we could only budget a year at a time. But he put his name on the line in his own company to bring it up for 15 years. As soon as our Sprint project manager got to Stockholm and this link opened up and everybody saw that it was possible, five people came up to him and said, I want one too. But, you know, it's like somebody has to make the first step, and the first step was made. Okay, so here's a look at the way things were then around 1994. And you see a lot of the links here were 64 or 128 kilobits per second. The first link from China came in at 64 kilobits per second. That was late in the game. We even had Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. We planned one from the United Arab Emirates. But let me talk about Latin America and, I guess the Caribbean came in a little bit later. But let me try and tell you how that happened. Luckily, there was a wonderful, wonderful guy in the Organization of American States. His name was Saul Hahn. And Saul eventually organized this program, eventually got a name for it called Red Husit, Red Hemisférica Académica para las Ciencias y Tecnología. I can never say technology right because it's the same word in so many languages and pronounced so many different ways. So I forget how you pronounce it in Spanish, but you know what I mean. Saul and I were able to work hand in hand because he could get money, OAS money, to buy things in your countries. Now, I couldn't use U.S. money to buy things in your countries, but I could help pay for the circuits to service to your countries. So Saul bought stuff in the countries, and also because he's Spanish-speaking to begin with, and second of all, because he represented the Organization of American States, he could negotiate with the governments of the countries. And, of course, I could work with Sprint and say, Sprint, please put in service. So what we did was we used PanAmSat, the satellite company, and they put a satellite terminal, and they had a big satellite terminal farm in Homestead, Florida. And so we had Sprint put a T1 link down to Miami and connect to Homestead. And then the various countries of Latin America and Caribbean could make individual connections over PanAmSat to Homestead, and then they come up and join the NSF. So that's, now, because almost no Latin American country had a connection directly to any other Latin American country, it meant that when they wanted to talk to each other, they had to go all the way up to Miami and then all the way back. But at least they could talk to each other. And I don't know if today every Latin American country's got connection to most other Latin American countries, but if they do, it's only a fairly recent thing with the new cables like Columbus that have come in. I sort of lost touch with what the latest developments were. But that's, again, that's sort of how it was in the early days. And I know of many, many trips that Saul made, and also, and I can't remember the gentleman's name from the West Indies.
Gotcha. Hashibashi?
No, no, it was before him. He was one of the early people that got a connection, and then he, well, see, what happened was as soon as somebody would get a connection and learn how to do it, then he would go and help other countries set up their things. So there was somebody from West Indies, just can't remember his name, who then worked with Saul to help other countries connect. And we had the same, you know, the same thing throughout Central America with Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua. So people really, you know, helped each other. But I'll tell you another anecdotal story there. In 1991, there was sort of the first meeting of Latin American networkers in Rio, in a place called IMPA. I can't say it in Portuguese, but it's sort of like Instituto Matemática para Instituto para Matemática Pura and something or Aplicada. It's a pure and applied Institute for Pure and Applied Mathematics, just outside of Rio, up in the hills. And what we wanted to do was Saul and I were there, and we wanted to get the Latin American networking people to work with each other to sort of form a cooperative organization. And they kept arguing, and they couldn't work with each other. And, you know, Saul was saying, well, if you work with each other, you know, I can help you with equipment, and Steve can help you with connectivity. And the Brazilian who organized this was a leader that was Tadao Takahashi, who came from originally a Japanese family, but he was Brazilian. And he was trying to get everybody to work together, and people just wouldn't work together. And so finally I said, okay, I might as well go home. And Saul said, sure, let's just go home early. And Tadao came to us and he said, no, stay one more day, please. And everybody went off, and I don't know what he said to them. So the next day, Friday, everybody came in and said, okay, we're going to work together. And that started, and they started a mailing list for collaboration. And I don't know if that mailing list, I think it's still around. It was called Enredo. Is Enredo still around? Okay, so this, you know, people like Ida Holtz and Jose Soriano and so forth were some of the originators of this thing. And, you know, there were other little stories that were kind of interesting. For example, Pan Am Sat had given a full transponder, 64 kilobit transponder, or full transponder, more than 64 kilobits, to Peru for some consideration, landing rights or whatever. So they had given, for landing rights, they had given a transponder or 64 kilobits, something like that, to the government of Peru. And so Jose Soriano wanted to use that, and nobody was using it. He wanted to use it for an internet connection for the academic community. Well, the minute other people in the government found out that Jose Soriano wanted to use it for something, they said, no, we want it. But they didn't have any use for it. They were clueless. They didn't know what they wanted it for. But, you know, it's the first time somebody tries to get something, a scarce commodity, everybody else decides they need it. And his life was threatened. His life was threatened on more than one occasion for trying to do this. So there are some real heroes in networking. I mean, it wasn't like Saul did everything. It wasn't like I was working with Saul. The real heroes were the people in the field who sometimes had to worry about their lives, their properties, their safety, who got these things done. These networks which you now use and say, oh, they're there, they're wonderful. There were a lot of potential blood on the line to make these things happen. I'm sure there are other stories like that. I remember the guy in the West Indies was Archie. What's Archie? Marshall. I'm sorry. I didn't understand you when you said Marshall. I thought you were saying Macho or something. Okay. Yeah, Archie Marshall. Yes. Archie is one of the other heroes there. Okay. So anyway, these things sort of develop one network at a time, one connection at a time, but they develop.
Can I ask you?
Yeah.
One link there down to South Africa. Africa.
South Africa?
Yeah.
Okay, you know, there was an embargo against dealing with South Africa during the days of apartheid. Okay, and the person, or one of the two people who founded Network Startup Resource Center was Randy Bush, who preceded Steve. And Randy is one of the true heroes of the network, okay? And actually, John Clinton founded the Network Startup Resource Center along with Randy. So Randy hosted UUCP connections from a lot of countries, including South Africa, which was not embargoed. And also, by the way, he went down in the same year that this conference in Rio, he went to Peru and taught all the university administrators how to set up UUCP. So once the internet link came in, all they had to do was flip a switch and convert it to internet. Okay. So Randy worked for a living but he did all this stuff pro bono, all this other stuff. So he worked with South Africa and hosted their UUCP connection. And they wanted to get an internet connection. I told them the minute that apartheid is lifted, we will work with you on an internet connection. And the very day that they lifted apartheid, I told Sprint, get a connection into South Africa. So that's how that thing happened. Okay. And we had a little bit of a problem there, too, because, see, to the NSFNet, there was sort of an admissions policy. In other words, we would route by institution, not by total network. And there was a government research and development laboratory in South Africa that wanted to connect. But this laboratory was also making military stuff, which was used against people inside South Africa. And so we were very strict about letting them connect, that they had to make sure that the laboratory was sectioned off and only the part that was dealing in peaceful research and development, not crowd control, was allowed to use the network. Of course, I don't know how much cheating went on, but we were very insistent on that. So that's... And, well, you know, I guess you must know now that South Africa, that the internet in South Africa is a huge business and thriving. But that was the early start. And I guess the people that we... This was, again, everything was university, academic networks. So the people in South Africa that then graduated from university and said, now what do we do for the network? We're used to using the internet. They went on to found internet companies. And that was the beginning of the internet industry in South Africa. Okay, so by 1996, this is just a list of the various countries, country networks which were connected. And one that I was particularly proud about, one that was more fun for me than anything else, was Mongolia. And that was the very last one. And the interesting thing there was that the U.S. ambassador to Mongolia had learned about the internet when he was visiting his brother-in-law in the United States. At that point, he didn't know anything about internet, and his brother-in-law showed him everything, and he said, oh, this would be wonderful for economic development in Mongolia. And somehow, people told him to find me at National Science Foundation. So he wanted me to help bring internet into Mongolia. Well, at the same time, scientists working with NSF grants were saying, we really need to be able to get to Mongolia on the internet because there is a lake there which is pristine, undisturbed, called Lake Hovsgol. And we wanted to do a lot of biological research because there are even some almost prehistoric organisms that are around there that are preserved. And so we need to be able to get internet into Mongolia. So I was having the scientific community, you know, pushing and the American ambassador pulling, and we worked together on this. And actually, his idea was wonderful. Let's not just make it a charitable thing. Let's help an entrepreneur in Mongolia set it up. And by the way, that entrepreneur is still the TLD manager for Mongolia. It's DataNet Corporation. So what he did was the American ambassador got, I think, a $75,000 loan to get a ground station antenna and the associated equipment. And it had to be shipped through Beijing, and there was a problem. Can we get it there quickly enough before, you know, the October winds start blowing and Mongolia freezes over? And it was a big rush and everything. And this guy was really clever. He set it up himself and everything. It was, you know, quite a thing. But the interesting thing here is the Butter Fund. This thing was funded by the Butter Fund. Now, the United States gave a lot of surplus butter to Mongolia, and the butter was sold to hotels, to citizens, and markets, and whatever. And all of the proceeds from the sales went into the Butter Fund. And the Butter Fund was supposed to be used for development. And it took two keys to unlock money from the Butter Fund. The U.S. ambassador and the Mongolian minister for interior or development, I forget what the precise title was. So they unlocked about $75,000 loan to buy the space station and everything else, and they set it up. And there was a little article in the Washington Post in January of 96 when the network went online, saw something about Butter Fund or Butterfly to Mongolia or something like that. So this was a fun one, and that was the last one we did under that program. Well, just to go along the line, we, instead of running our own network anymore, we just couldn't afford to do it, so we said we can let commercial operators, network service providers, run the service for the universities as long as they all connected at regional hubs, so that a university could choose whatever commercial provider they wanted because they'd all be interconnected somehow, so the universities could still talk to each other. And that really didn't work out very well, actually, because what happened was that the networks were always under provision and the traffic was very slow. So eventually this led to the founding of this Internet 2 organization. And also we founded this other thing, I should mention it, Very High Speed Backbone Network Service, VBNS, for research applications as opposed to things like email and so forth. So again, it was like a second wave. First, everybody wanted to connect to the NSFNet, and then when the NSFNet became old hat, everybody wanted to connect to the VBNS. And so we had yet another issue because we had high-speed networks in various parts of the world. Japan had something, Canada and Europe had something going, but Japan couldn't talk to Europe. Japan could talk to us for a couple of very special connections, not to the whole network. And Canada had a deal with Europe, but people just couldn't talk to each other. So this was brought up in the G7, a project that Al Gore actually did start. He didn't invent the Internet, but he started this project about high-performance networks. It was called GIBBON, Global Interoperability of Broadband Networks. What we did was we created a connect point in Chicago where high-speed networks from other countries could connect. And you say, well, why Chicago? Well, if we put it on the West Coast, everybody in Europe would complain, and if we put it on the East Coast, everybody in the Pacific would complain. So we chose to put it in Chicago where everybody could complain equally. Seriously, that was... Also, we had good people in Chicago. So this was, again, an example of countries that were connected through the StarTAP. And to this day, StarTAP is now obsolete. It has transitioned to a thing called StarLite, or here are just some of the countries. It has transitioned to the optical now interconnect point, and there are several in the States now, but there is still one in Chicago, StarLite, where light waves are connected, you know, dedicated light paths on fiber optics of a gigabit per second or 10 gigabits per second. And it's actually located at Northwestern University. And again, I was afraid this would happen when I transferred the stuff to the ICANN stuff. Some of the characters didn't come through okay, but the picture's there. And I won't go into this thing. But what I want to talk about was the other thing that I'd like you to be aware of. The commercial nets were starting up, at least in the States, and some in Europe. And the crossover point by almost any measure that you want to use was 1994. Okay. What was happening was that the .edu, the educational networks, the .org, the .gov, those things were growing at a nice steady rate. And the commercials were down here, and all of a sudden the commercials started to take off, you know, orders of magnitude. And that crossover point was about 1994. And so this was a map that was made sort of in that time frame. Well, the map, oh, I'm sorry, in 1998. But this was a map that was made and showing the federal networks, the academic networks, NSF, Department of Energy, NASA, DARPA. And so this was an idea of their basic backbones. And here were the commercial nets in 1998. And if you combine the two together, you almost didn't see the academic networks because they were swamped by the commercial networks. So that's just an illustration. Okay, now I want to switch to a little bit of the ICANN issue. In the Internet, where are there opportunities for governance? Things that have to be regulated, things that have to be worked out, things that require cooperation and so forth. For example, you know, you worry about illegal activity like fraud, you know, all the different kinds of fraud, I'm sure, child pornography, trafficking, gambling, theft, stalking people, all those things. Theft and then identity theft and fraud, phishing, farming, all those things. And so you might have some regulation if governments got together and regulated things like that and these intellectual property agreements and so forth. And standards are developed in the Internet Engineering Task Force, IETF, but not all of them. But there's, again, room for some things, security and so forth, for governments to get together and deal with some issues. Some, in addition to illegal activity, of course, there's all the legal stuff like commerce. I don't mean, you know, suing people, but there's stuff that we do every day, the social networks like, what do the kids call it? MySpace. MySpace, right. I'm getting along in years. I don't do those things. Of course, the educational, the entertainment, it's increasingly the network's being used for entertainment, for YouTube, and maybe it'll be able to handle movie downloads. There's a question as to whether the network is ever going to be up to it, because
a very respected professor at Cambridge University did some calculations about what it would take for servers in a network center where networks connect to each other, about the heat load on servers to be able to download movies in real time and so forth. And his conclusion was they couldn't get enough heat dissipation. It would generate so much heat using current solid-state technology. This is John Prokrop, for anybody who knows the name, that it may never work. Of course, if we go to optical technology, maybe it would. I mean, there's always advances. But anyway, this is how the network is being used for legal kind of stuff. And then, of course, the applications that people do, you know, the browse, the video, audio, and so forth, just looking at it from the point of view of applications. You know that there's a certain amount of regulation there, like the European community says to Microsoft, you've got a one bundle and things like that. So there's some governance issues there. And then finally, you know, operations and services, like the companies that do the transmission, the ISPs, the people who do the routing, the hosting, and so forth. And then there's this little area about internet names, DNS, and the numbers, the internet addresses. So when you look at this whole thing, there's this little area here. Okay? And yet, when people talk about internet governance, they keep pointing at ICANN, which is just this little part here. And, you know, my own sense is that there's really something going on. There are other axes to grind, but they point at internet governance and they say, we've got to take over ICANN, or, you know, ICANN shouldn't be doing it on its own, or whatever the stories are. And really, there's this whole universe. Well, there are probably several reasons for that. And one of the reasons that I wanted to, one of the thoughts that I wanted to leave you with is that all the rules change when there's real money on the table. And in this space that ICANN helps to coordinate, not we don't rule it. I hope you get, when you go home at the end of this week, you'll understand that ICANN tries to coordinate things and is a bottom-up, multi-stakeholder kind of model where we, you know, coordinate things and get people to cooperate. We don't rule, but yet we're being, you know, people are accusing us of governing the internet. Well, whatever governing there is by consensus. But again, there's the monies here, because people are making hundreds of millions of dollars in internet names, in domain names. I read an article once by some guy who says, I'm only 38 years old, I own a lot of sites, there's advertising on the sites. I just sit home and make five-figure income every year doing nothing, because I own these sites. Okay? This was an example. I try to visualize things sometimes by looking at charts. I don't do very well visualizing the tables of words. We all sort of work differently. And this was from my dissertation back in 1981, where I was looking at an economic model, or an engineering economic model for decision making. And if you just looked at the engineering, you got two straight lines. It really doesn't matter what it was. Well, actually, what it was, I was looking at two ways of manufacturing something. One where you've got really dedicated equipment because you know you're going to make millions and millions of an item. And the other way, you've got flexible manufacturing equipment where if you don't, for some reason the market falls out and there's no demand for your item, you can use the machinery to make something else. But it's less efficient, so it costs you more to make something initially. So depending on how many you think you're going to sell, you choose one way or the other way. And so there's a crossover point. If you think you're going to sell this many, you choose one. If you think you're going to make something down here, you would choose the other. That's a pretty straightforward thing. But that was just simple engineering calculation. Now, the minute you throw in things like double declining balance, tax advantages, investment tax credit, and discounting to present value, these two simple lines start looking like this. The crossover point changes. Everything changes. And that was a simple thing. But that's sort of my way of visualizing to myself that when you start talking about real money, everything changes. All the rules change. And the funny thing is I was using an example here from Buick, that General Motors actually gave me real numbers from some design things that they were considering about making a small engine that would either work on 8 cylinders or 5 cylinders, and should they go one way or another. And they were interested in what the output of my model would be, and I sent it to them. And so you know what they did? They outsourced it to Suzuki. So again, when there's real money on the table, all the rules change. Don't forget that. Okay, well, thank you all very much for listening.
I don't know if there's time for questions or if you have questions, but feel free to ask. Remember, I don't work for anybody anymore, so I'll give you honest answers. Don't be polite or afraid. You know? Nobody's got bananas to throw, so, or tomatoes or whatever is thrown. Yes?
You told us a lot about the history of the internet, and you're basically relaxing now. And you said you don't work for anybody, but where would you like to see the internet go? What would you like to see happen with the internet?
I'll try and answer that this way. In 1994, I think it was, I was invited to the Philippines to give lectures about the internet. And this was the time that the Philippines was putting in its first 64 kilobit link to us for their academic community. So I lectured at universities all over the Philippines over about a 10-day period. Now, there was some guy working in the U.S. Embassy there who was really good with computers and programming and so forth, and he talked about interactive applications. And I said, what do you mean? Because, you know, all we could do then was sort of download the way I showed you or send email. And he said, well, you know, it'll be possible that you could enter something in your computer and you could interact with a site. And I could hardly believe that. What was that? CGIs. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, you can tell I'm not a programmer. So these were CGI scripts that he was, you know, the early kinds of things. And to me that was just, you know, unbelievable that that could happen. I mean, now look at what's happening. So in terms of prognostications, you know, I have no idea. But let me find a slide I had on this. Okay, here's some things that are probably happening or likely to happen and so forth. And I mean, in terms of where I'd like to see things go, it's sort of a question I can't begin to answer. But some things that I think are happening right now is, as I mentioned, entertainment over the internet. A year or two ago, YouTube was just a little toy. Okay, so now Google buys YouTube. YouTube is now going international, different character sets, different countries, and the quality of the stuff over YouTube is getting better. And you know, I have no doubts that that's going to grow into some really almost some commercial quality stuff. There are other things like YouTube that are now downloading commercial stuff. I played with some, but I can't even remember their names right now. So certainly entertainment, is downloading of entertainment is going to grow, and it's going to happen really fast. It's happening now. You know about these internationalized domain names, that we're talking about that all week. So that's certainly something that's going to happen, and the only question is, how fast can we introduce them in a way that's going to be fair and equitable and not break the internet? And a whole lot of people are working on that right now. And there are some parts of the world that at the second level have internationalized things now. The Arab League, Iran, China, Russia, Israel, maybe some other places I don't know about. So that will happen. We know that the IP version 4 address space that we're using now is running out, and there are various estimates as to when it's going to actually run out. But the best estimates now are between 2009 and 2011. Okay. Remember, when there's money on the table, the rules are going to change. So what's going to happen is things get very scarce. And some of these things are happening already. There's going to be a market black market in IPv4 addresses. Okay. Now, what's happening already, by the way, is that some companies are buying out other companies, especially failing companies, just so they can have their IPv4 addresses. Remember, when there's money on the table, strange rules, strange things happen. Okay? And then the question is, you know, how can we introduce IP version 6? How can we run IPv4 and IPv6 together? And there's no really easy answers. There's some partial solutions, but it's going to be painful. Has this been explained to you, tasting and kiting?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is what I'm saying again. When there's money on the table, God knows what's going to happen. But this is where I mentioned that this guy was saying that I just sort of sit back and make 5 figures a year because I own some popular sites with advertising on it, and I get paid every time somebody clicks on an ad. So what's going to happen here, I'm not sure. And now, I'm sure there are going to be some failures in different parts of the internet, and that's something we're trying to deal with now, to see at least when registrars or maybe even registries fail, how can we deal with it? Now, one thing that I think is going to complicate this thing very much is that we're beginning to feel that, you know, we have some ideas of how to deal with these things that happen in places where we can understand the languages, that happen in places with ASCII characters. Okay, or even almost ASCII characters. For example, if they introduce French at least we can understand it and deal with it. But what's going to happen if there are business failures in mainland China or India, where there are different character sets and different cultures than we know how to deal with, where the business models that we know that are familiar to us, you know, here in ICANN and in the West are very different, where the legal systems are different? How will we as ICANN, even though we're a global entity, but how are we going to be equipped to go in and do something there if there are business failures? And I'm sure that we don't know the answers right now because we're just learning how to deal with business failures in the world that we know about. So I couldn't answer the question that you asked me, but here's some of the things that I sort of have in mind. Sure. Anybody else? Well, again, thank you all very much for your kind attentiveness.
ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, presented